This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Last week, the three New York City police officers on trial for killing Sean Bell were acquitted. The trial and the verdict stirred some deeply rooted sentiments of mistrust between African Americans and the police. Civil rights advocates say there needs to be reform on how police approach and handle suspects. But many police officers say they are likely to use deadly force if a suspect is thought to have a weapon, as was the case in the slaying of Sean Bell. Today, we talk about the culture of fear behind and in front of the badge. Later in the hour, the Olympic torch has yet another mountain to climb. But first, fear of police, fear of suspects. If you've had an experience that has led you to mistrust police, or if you are a law enforcement officer, tell us your story. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, and our email address is talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog. It is at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we begin with Kyle Murphy. He is a retired lieutenant in the New York Police Department, and he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times called "The Fear Behind the Badge," about what it's like for police when they feel their life's in danger. He joins us from the studios at the Journalism School at Columbia University in New York City. Welcome. Thanks so much for being with us, Mr. Murphy.
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
Tell me, as a police officer, did you ever feel so afraid that you were ready to use your weapon?
Well, there were instances when I came, you know, very close, but certainly not to the level that, you know, Detective Znora felt when he had to make that decision.
Explain what happened to you and why you didn't use it. What was the situation?
Well, the situation that I wrote about in the Times was back in 1986, and my partner and I responded to the Port Authority of a report of a man with a knife, and he was you know, brandishing the knife, and we approached him, and I took out my gun, and I pointed it at him, and thankfully my partner was able to get close enough and take his nightstick and chop down on the man's arm, and he dropped the knife, and I didn't have to shoot. But the point I was trying to make in the article was, in that situation, I knew what I was facing because I could clearly see the threat, as opposed to the Bell case, when you had guys that had to make a decision where they were, you know, almost certain that somebody had a gun, but unfortunately it turned out that they didn't.
Well, what did you think when you heard the verdict in the Sean Bell case, first of all?
Well, I was happy. I didn't think that they should have been convicted. You know, I understand the other side of the argument, but I think people need to think about, you know, what the cops go through as well. And, you know, the fear that they might have whenever they're confronted with somebody who's not listening to their commands. And, like, you know, they overheard somebody said that, you know, that they did have a gun. So my point was to get the public to think about what a police officer thinks just before he might have to use deadly physical force.
Well, give us a sense of what might be going through a police officer's mind when he or she is responding to somebody that has a weapon or they think might have a weapon or is acting in some kind of threatening way. What is that state of mind like?
Well, I mean, you're very scared, you know, and you're not only scared for your life, you're also scared that, you know, whether or not you're going to make the right decision. So, you know, and that decision happens in like seconds. So you're making a decision, you know, should I shoot? Is my life in danger? And, you know, what if I make a mistake? I'm going to be in a lot of trouble. So I think those two things go through your mind at the same time, and it's very hard to make a decision, you know, when your adrenaline's going and your blood is going, and, you know, it's a hard decision to make.
Now, one thing I know, you know, when I've covered these kinds of things, the police will often say, well, we're going to put in a training program or where there's need for more training. But you make the point that while training can instill good habits, it doesn't necessarily control fear. You say the question, is my life in danger, can't be answered in a classroom. So where does that leave the public then? Does it just have to trust that an officer is going to somehow find a way to control that fear and make the right call? I mean, where does that leave us?
That's kind of hard to answer, Lynn, you know, because, like, nobody will know, you know, what they're going to do in that situation until they're actually faced with it. You know, how can you recreate that fear in a training scenario? So, I mean, you know, I can say I hope that department, you know, the police department would hire the best and the brightest people, and you know, and that's something that you can do. But as far as when you're faced with that moment, which most cops in their career are never faced with, that they have to make that decision, that, you know, that you make the right decision.
You say most cops actually never really do fire a weapon. Is that what you're saying there?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, most cops, you know, throughout the course of their career, and I had a 20-year career, They never discharge their weapons, you know, nor do they ever get shot at. So the situation that Detective Aznora found himself in, you know, most police officers never face that. And even a cop, not only the public can second guess, but even police can second guess and think to themselves, well, what would I have done in that situation? Because most cops don't even know, because they never quite face that level of fear.
All right, let's take a call now. We're going to go to Bill in Chicago. I want to remind our listeners that we are talking about the fear of police and the fear that police may feel when they are confronting a suspect, and how that can play into these violent situations that occur. And, of course, we're talking about the fact that three police officers in New York City were acquitted in the killing of Sean Bell. And if you are a law enforcement agent and would like to participate in the conversation, or if you've had a difficult situation with a police officer, we'd like to hear from you. The number is 800-989-8255. Sorry, I forgot the number for a second there. I'm sorry to confuse you. Let's take a call now from Bill in Chicago. Hi, Bill.
Yes, good afternoon. I was a police dispatcher and 911 call taker for about 5.5 years in South Bend, Indiana. And one of the things the public needs to remember is that the only information that officers get is what directly comes from that 911 call and from the dispatcher. If someone even remotely hints there might be a weapon involved, we have to put that out, because our main consideration as a dispatcher is officer safety, and that also provides officer safety to other officers. There may be officers nearby where if it's a routine call, they might not respond. But the minute a weapon becomes involved, everybody starts thinking worst-case scenario. Officers are trained to respond in that nature, and even we as dispatchers. If a call goes from a routine call to a weapon-involved call, there's a whole different mindset that we get in, because we can have situations, and I was working a night, one of our officers was shot during a routine traffic stop that escalated into a vehicle pursuit. The officer was shot 3 times at close range with no warning whatsoever. So it's nice for the public to always second-guess police officers, but there really is, it's a momentary snap decision that officers make in any situation like this, and it's unfortunate when it goes bad for the public at large. But I never see the same level of concern when it's an officer that made the wrong decision and winds up dead. And I'll take the answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Bill. Would you like to respond to that, Kyle?
There's not much I could really say in response to that. I think you kind of said it all right there.
But I was thinking, as he was saying that, then an officer might be going into a situation with this information in the back of his head, whether it's right or wrong, that there is a weapon, and that would contribute then to whatever fear there might be and whatever adrenaline might be pumping that would lead to a bad situation.
Right, and that's exactly what happened, you know, in the Bell case. They were there, you know, supposedly just for like a prostitution and possibly drugs inside the Club Kahlua. And then once, you know, somebody made a statement of a possible gun, you know, everybody's ears gets raised up and the situation just changes drastically.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about one other thing you said in your piece. You said that the officer who fired first has the greater moral responsibility, because once he fired, contagious shooting took hold. And I wondered, first of all, when you say contagious shooting, what does that mean? I think I have an idea, but I also wondered why police shouldn't be held responsible for something like contagious shooting that ends in death. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that for me.
Well, contagious shooting is when, you know, somebody fires and then, you know, the rest of the team or the rest of the cops around start firing as well. And it's difficult to, you know, to tell where the shot came from, who fired it. And once you hear that first shot, you know, then everybody else just starts to, you know, start shooting as well. It's difficult to stop once it starts. And as far as Nora being more morally responsible, I still don't think he should have been convicted. But I think that, you know, he was the one that made that decision, that thought that, you know, that Guzman had a gun. And if he didn't fire first, then maybe nobody else would have fired. So I hold him more responsible, like, you know, morally, and it's something he's going to have to live the rest of his life with, that he took somebody's life, you know, Sean Bell's life, and he didn't have a gun. So that's what he's going to have to live with.
All right,
I think the other officers are not quite as responsible for firing once he fired first.
All right, let's take one more call before we move to our next guest. We're going to talk to Kenny in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Kenny.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Kenny. Yeah, I was just calling in. I want to just add to, you know, from a different perspective of someone who's been on the other side of that. But before I say that, you know, I understand that, you know, being a police officer, not always the safest thing. You know, you're dealing with people out there, criminals, and that kind of sets the stage for, I think, when you come into contact. But having said that, as a 15-year-old, we were three friends of mine riding around, going to so we were pulled over for a traffic violation, supposedly. We were never given any citation. And, you know, after cops asked us questions, who we were, where we were going, our ages, we answered, cooperated. 20 minutes later, we're still at the place. And, you know, the cop was just basically, you know, was just trying to see. I don't know if he was trying to get a rise out of us or what, but we ended up getting into a situation where, you know, we got shoved around, roughed up, ended up getting taken to the local precinct, had our parents called and everything, and, you know, just a bad experience. And, you know, it kind of created a climate, I think, where, you know, this was back in the early 80s.
Yeah.
So, I think in situations like that where people out here, you know, having confrontations or contact with police officers that aren't really professional in their job, you know, it's a two-way street. So I think that, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword. You know, police are afraid because they got cops who aren't professional, and people are afraid of coming into contact with cops because, you know, those things kind of perpetuate, both sides being afraid of each other.
So, yeah. Kenny, I'd like to get Mr. Murphy to respond. I want to thank you for bringing up that point. And Kyle Murphy, if you could respond, please.
Well, Lynn, you know, I can't defend everything that the police do, you know, and maybe in the situation he's talking about, maybe he ran into a bad cop. I mean, there are bad cops out there that do some bad things, but I don't think it happened in the Sean Bell situation.
But I guess he's bringing up the point that I mean, it's on both sides. That's one of the things we're looking at, and we're going to have some other guests on the show as well. But there's fear on both sides that contributes to this situation.
Absolutely.
And one would hope somehow, I guess, to get back to the point that maybe there is something, some training or something that could be done to help cops, you know, hold themselves back at times.
Well, I think, you know, like I said, I mean, there's things you can do beforehand. And it was an issue in the Sean Bell thing as to whether or not the cops identified themselves.
Right.
And, you know, that was a point of contention. So, you
Kyle,
know, the judge. Yeah,
I'm
sure.
Sorry. Hold on a second. We're going to have to take a short break.
Okay.
I just want to let our audience know you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about fear of police and fear of suspects. And we'll talk more with Kyle Murphy, a retired lieutenant in the New York Police Department. We're taking your calls at 800-989-8255 or send us an email to talk@npr.org. Kyle Murphy, just to finish the point that you were making before and the last point that I wanted to ask you about, and that was just to return briefly to this question of, you know, what is the police officer's responsibility, understanding that he's in a situation sometimes where he has to make a split-second decision and there's a lot of fear going on. Is there anything an officer can do, in your opinion, to sort of keep that under check so that he does make the right judgment call?
Well, as a team that did that operation, you know, I think that they just got to be, you know, as best equipped as they possibly can. And like I said, during the trial, it was a point of contention as to whether or not did the cops identify themselves. You know, Bell's friend said no, and the cops say yes, and the judge seemed to believe the cops. So, you know, so as far as, you know, the only thing you can do is to – I'm sorry, Lynn, I lost my train of thought there.
All right. Well, the only thing you can do is hope. It sounds like you're saying the only thing a cop can do is really hope he does make the right judgment call. It sounds like that's where you're leaving it. Is that right?
Yeah, and like I said, the cops can be better trained to identify, to identify themselves. And like in that situation, if they were clearly identified with, you know, with ray jackets and whatever, you know, maybe it wouldn't have been an issue at all. So that was the point that I was trying to make, that they need to be, you know, have better equipped and be able to, you know, and be identified, so it's not even a point of contention in a situation, you know, as volatile as that one was.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Kyle.
Thank you very much for having me.
Kyle Murphy is a retired lieutenant in the New York Police Department. His op-ed, The Fear Behind the Badge, was published this weekend in the New York Times, and he joined us from the studios at the Journalism School at Columbia University in New York City. Joining us now is Kai Wright. He's a columnist for TheRoot.com, and he wrote the column, If They Are So Scared, How Come We Are the Dead Ones, for the website. He joins us from NPR Studios in New York City. Thanks for being with us, Kai.
Thanks for having me.
Let me ask you first, what went through your mind when you first heard the verdict in the Sean Bell case?
Well, I have to say, from a sort of from the law point of view, and I'm not I'm in no way legally trained, but I wasn't shocked by the verdict. While you're as we watched the coverage, the case that the DA made was seemed to be shaky from the start, and there was a lot of question about whether the DA was the appropriate person to try it, and whether or not the DA's office was really committed to the case in the first instance. But beyond the law of it, and whether or not they were going, whether or not they were guilty of the charges, there's obviously a broader justice question that to me and to many black folks in the city felt terribly familiar. Because of this fear we've been talking about, any reaction to that fear is justified. You don't have to. It is rational for a police officer to imagine a gun and kill a man, and it doesn't matter whether the man actually had the gun or not. And that seems to be a long and recurring pattern in the way that black communities in the city are policed, and it's troubling and it's scary as a black man.
Yeah, and you say all cops, and you say this is even true if the officers are people of color, as was the case with two of the officers in the Sean Bell shooting. You say they all operate within a bureaucracy that encourages them to see black men as combatants.
Right. I mean, it's very easy to, when we talk about race, we so often want to individualize it. We want to make it about, this person's a racist and this person's not, and it matters whether you're black, white, purple, or green. Race is a systemic question. It's a broader cultural question. And cops of all colors operate within a system that encourages them to see black communities as areas of combat. And that feeds this fear that we're talking about. And so just to think through some common sense examples, you know, I mean, a comparison to the Sean Bell situation or the nightclubs in Chelsea, which is on the west side of Manhattan, a largely white area. And, you know, they're very popular nightclubs. There are often a problem for law enforcement. They have to be police. There's drugs. There was a series of rapes there at one point. No one ever gets shot. You know, the cops never suddenly think someone's got a gun and kill them. That only seems to happen in black neighborhoods. And when you look back at all of these examples, now stretching back, sadly, decades in New York, this only happens in neighborhoods that are majority black. And you have to start asking if that's the outcome. If the outcome is race-based, what is it then that's driving that outcome?
All right. And let me also ask you about your own fear that you talked about, the fear on the other side of this equation, and that is and the mistrust on the part of African-Americans toward the police. And how does that play into whatever the dynamic is that occurs that can lead to such a terrible situation?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure how it plays into the dynamic. I can certainly say that it has been striking throughout my life. I fear the police far more than I do the people they're purportedly policing. I should say, I want to stress that, you know, I believe police are important. By and large, most police are doing their job and doing it well. Because you see incidents like these, you know, we used to joke about it in your family growing up. Look, if you ever get pulled over, don't do anything to scare the cop. From the earliest ages, can remember sitting around in my grandmother's kitchen and listening to my father and my uncle joke about it. Don't do anything to scare the cop, because you never know what is going to set them off. And that is, it starts as a joke, but it's real. And again, when you look at cases like this, you look at cases like Timothy Stansbury a few years back, 19-year-old kid in a public housing in Brooklyn was going up to the roof. Some cops were conducting a rooftop patrol. One of them opened the door. The other one pointed his barrel down the gun, down a barrel of his gun down the stairwell, saw the kid and shot him. Well, he was scared. He didn't expect the guy coming. But why was he pointing his gun down the stairwell in the first instance? That kind of thing is so widespread, you have to ask, is this a systemic problem?
All right. Let's take a call now. Frank in Chicago. Hello, Frank. Go ahead.
Yes. I can't believe, for one, we're even discussing this issue. Like, white people don't know. You really don't know how it is that, you know, for African-Americans or Puerto Rican-Americans or any brown people? I mean, it happens all the time.
Has it happened to you? Why don't you tell us, maybe you can tell us something that happened to you that would enlighten us.
One, here, I'm 19 years old at the time. My girlfriend's in college. I got a full-time job. We're coming home from the movie theater. We're walking down the street. There's some kind of appliance store or whatever. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. A dog on the inside of the appliance store jumps at the door. It's a glass door, barks, big, huge dog. I'm frightened. She's frightened. It was just startled. Some cops drove by and grab me, throw me down to the ground, tell my wife or tell my girlfriend she better shut up or she's going to jail, blah, blah, blah. And I asked them what I did. They kicked me. They beat me, whatever. They sent me to jail. For the whole weekend, I was sent to jail for disorderly conduct, and I had nothing. I didn't even do with anything. And that was the first time I've ever been to jail. Now, at that point, now I got a record.
I can hear that you're still angry about this, and I can understand why.
Well, I'm angry. And then another thing, that guy who, I mean, anybody can identify themselves as a police officer in the, you know, and say, you know, with a gun, you could still be getting robbed or carjacked or whatever. I mean, you could put a silver dollar in your wallet and flip it with your ID and say you're a cop.
Yeah. Let me ask.
There's no reason to shoot a guy as many times as they shot the guy and then reload.
All right, Frank. I really appreciate your comments. I would really like Kai to respond to what you're saying because
okay.
I think he's really confirming the points that you've been making. Thanks for the call, Kai.
Thank you.
Well, again, I focus on the systemic question. And I think that, again, most cops are doing their job and doing it well. And as Kyle pointed out, most cops actually don't ever find themselves in the position where they have to use their weapon or they think someone else has a weapon. But when the way in which we police black communities sets up a combative atmosphere. And so I think I was doing a story a few months back about a neighborhood in Brooklyn where New York is experiencing the lowest crime rate, lowest violence crime rate in its history right now. And so we're all celebrating that. But there's areas of Brooklyn where that's not the case. And they are, you know, they're poorer ghettos. And so I was doing a story out there a few months ago, and I was talking to a lot of the young men and about their relationship with the police and whether or not they're going to help the police in their work. And it's like talking, you know, and these are kids at community centers. And it's like they're telling stories about going to the movies when they talk about the number of times that they have been stopped and frisked, the number of times that they have been approached as though they were a criminal, where they'll be at a subway stop. I remember a kid was telling me he had two priors. I was like, well, how'd you end up with two priors? He said, well, I was on the subway stop, and I got into a shouting match with a guy from school, and the cop came along and arrested us both.
Hmm.
Now, in a white neighborhood, that's just a shouting match. Hey, break it up and move on. In Brownsville, Brooklyn, that's a potential gang fight. And so those guys are criminals. And so that combative posture with which black communities are policed is the sort of thing that sets the stage for these fear-based freakouts when there's a tense situation like it was outside of the nightclub with Sean Bell and his friends.
All right, let me take a call now from Robert in Interlochen, Michigan. Hi, Robert.
Yeah, how are you?
Good. Go ahead.
My son this Saturday is graduating from the police academy here in northern Michigan, and he's been keeping me informed of his training throughout the entire process. And I've got to tell you, as a father and somebody who's had experience of 20 years in the martial arts, how slanted the training is to benefit the minimum amount of risk to the suspect as possible, in spite of the injury that a police officer can get. I mean, they are trained to do everything conceivably possible not to hurt or harm the suspect. And as a father, I'm concerned for his own safety at the amount of one-sidedness that the academies are now taking to make sure that the officers do not hurt suspects.
All right. Thanks for that call, Robert. And I want to bring another guest into this discussion now who can perhaps respond to the point that you are making. With us now is Peter Moskos. He is the author of Cop in the Hood and a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And he joins us from his home in Queens, New York. Welcome to the program, Mr. Moskos.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I know you've been listening in, and perhaps you just heard that last call where the man was making the point that he feels that officers are being trained to use the least amount of brutal strength as necessary. On the other hand, clearly we're hearing times when officers overstep their bounds in arresting people, perhaps for no reason. And, of course, sometimes this can lead to extremely violent situations. So where do we begin to seek a solution to this?
I think first, I think you're talking about two different problems to some extent. One is rude cops, or what Lieutenant Murphy said earlier. I mean, there are bad cops out there. We all know that. I think that's a different issue than you find in cases of police-involved shootings where cops use lethal force. I don't think it's good to confuse those two, because the best cop in the world placed in a situation where he or she fears for his or her life is going to do what it takes to protect lives. That, I think, is a separate issue than and it's more than anecdotal evidence, but the anecdotal evidence that's been offered talking about individual cases of basically mistreatment at the hands of police officers.
I think what we're talking about, and let me just remind our audience for a moment that you are listening to Talk the Nation from NPR News. And Peter Moscoso, I think part of what we're talking about, though, is that there is certainly mistrust and fear on the part of many people in the African-American community toward police, and we're also hearing there's fear on the other side of the badge that can turn into these combustible situations.
Yeah, I think, the responsibility is on both sides a little bit. I think that police can make a much better effort to get involved with the whole community. Having policed myself in a relatively dangerous part of Baltimore, I'm certainly familiar with the fear from behind the badge. Getting more police out of their cars and not just responding to radio calls. More foot patrol, I think, allows police to deal with everybody in the community, so you don't get the biased perspective that everybody you deal with is a criminal. Because in large part, I mean, that's a police job, is to deal with criminals. But it's important for police to remember that, you know, there are good people out there, too. And I think that's something that police can do. On the public side, there's a certain... I tell my students this a lot because they tell the same stories. You have to pick your battles. There are ways to not to just deal with police, but to deal with everybody. Chris Rock on the Chris Rock Show did a bit a few years back on it's a word I can't use on the radio, but how to not get your butt kicked by the police. And of course, it's a comedic piece, but the advice he gives is spot on. I mean, he says obey the law, use common sense, be polite, shut up, stop when police ask you to. These are sort of common sense principles that every, if the public followed that more, these incidents would often be avoided.
Kai Wright, I'm just curious to hear your reaction to that, because on a certain level, it also reminds me of what you said before, which was that when you were growing up, you were taught certain behaviors that you should practice when you're dealing with the police.
Absolutely. And, that's the case. Certainly not starting a fight with the police is a good way not to get in one. But it is worth pointing out that when we look at the cases of people, of these black men who have been shot by the NYPD over the last several years, few of them were engaging the police in any way when it started. Timothy Stansbury was minding his business going to the top of a roof when the cop shot him in his chest. We can go through the same scenario with Amadou Diallo and a whole list of folks before it. Sean Bell was minding his business. I mean, there was a fight, but why? The question is, when it does lead to violence, state-sponsored violence, why is it that so disproportionately the police officer perceives a mortal threat when he or she is policing a black community than elsewhere? And that's, I think, the question we have to ask is why is it that outcome? Why do we see such a lopsided outcome on the perception of threat? And I think that, yes, is about some of the things that citizens do, but I think it's about the culture in which, the way in which those neighborhoods are policed more so.
Those are good points, but I think it's also important to mention it's also about the culture of the neighborhoods. I'm not naive enough to think that race doesn't matter in this country or in policing, but I think from the police perspective, it's not so race focused. It's the problem happens when you're in a neighborhood where there is a lot of violence. Unfortunately, these happen to be more often than not black neighborhoods compared to white neighborhoods.
Peter Moskos and Kai Wright, if you can stay with us, we're going to continue this conversation when we return from a break. And we're also going to hear about the Olympic torch, which may be climbing Mount Everest, and that means that some people may not be able to reach that peak. Both of those will be coming up after a short break. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Last week, three New York police officers were found not guilty of wrongdoing in the shooting of Sean Bell, an unarmed man they suspected was carrying a weapon. The verdict only added to a culture of fear in front of and behind the badge. We're going to be discussing that with my guest, but first, I just wanted to let you know of the headlines that we're following today at NPR News. Barack Obama says that he is outraged by the latest assertion by his former pastor, Jeremiah Wright, that criticism of his fiery sermons is an attack on the black church. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton has picked up the endorsement of North Carolina Governor Mike Easley. The North Carolina and Indiana primaries are a week from today. And Grand Theft Auto 4 comes out today, one of the most highly anticipated video games ever. The game is hugely popular and has been mired in controversy because of its signature carjacking, drug dealing, sex, and violence. Details on those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from NPR News. And joining me right now are Kai Wright. He's a columnist for TheRoot.com, and he wrote a column about the culture of fear police have toward black people. I'm also joined by Peter Moskos. He's the author of Cop in the Hood and a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And we're going to take a call from Jim, and he's calling from Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Good. I'm from Cincinnati, and as your guests may know, we had some civil unrest in 2001, which resulted in a lawsuit against Cincinnati, which Saul Green from Detroit oversaw, and we're in the fifth year of that now. Anyhow, I've been involved in issues in the city. I live in the city of Cincinnati, and I went to the Cincinnati Police Academy, which now trains, and I say in a much better way than it did 7-8 years ago as a result of the collaborative which we have in Cincinnati. And as part of the training as a civilian, we had to do one night virtual reality where I had a weapon which shot red and green, and we had on the wall situations which the police face. And in one instant, I think in a tenth of a second, you had to make up your mind whether or not you were going to shoot or not to shoot. And that made me aware for the very first time in my life what the police face in every situation, whether it's in a black community or a white community. But we also have learned that what everybody on your program has said is correct. The fear of the black community of police is real and genuine and based on reality. And it's a reverse trend, too. The fear of the police when they have to use their weapons is equally strong. So I think what everybody's saying is true. I think the issue's become, it is on both sides of the weapon, but I do think what your speaker has said about the issue of black community fearing police is genuinely true and a result of some very valid history. It's unfortunate, but it is true. We also have begun to use tasers here, which, as some of your speakers know, resulted in some conflict, too. But give me a choice between being hit with a taser and being shot at by a real weapon. I'll take the taser any time. But Cincinnati's gone through some very positive results out of the civil unrest that we had in 2001, and the police here are being trained extraordinarily better. Are there still issues? Sure. The RAND community is following this very – the RAND Corporation is following this very closely. We meet twice a year with them to hear how we're doing.
Yeah.
We're doing much better. I just, you know, wonder – I'm a civilian and 73 years old, so – and I'm now in the Urban League downtown working with a group called Ceasefire Cincinnati, which we get out of Chicago. And your speakers probably know about that. I just want to make these comments and wonder what they had to say.
All right. Thanks so much. Thanks for calling, Jim.
Yeah. Thanks.
Peter Moskos, are you familiar with what's going on in Cincinnati, or do you have any response to that?
Well, I mean, my response is it's what Kai said earlier. There is a greater issue here of moral justice that needs to be addressed. And that, unfortunately, like the trial of the officers that killed Sean Bell, a criminal trial is not the place to address those issues. I agree with Lieutenant Murphy when he was on earlier saying I think the verdict was the correct decision, but that doesn't address these issues of, you know, why does this keep happening? The problem is these trials come to symbolize a lot more than the actual criminal guilt of the defendants.
Well, let me just ask you this. I mean, when do you hold the police responsible for making the wrong call at that moment? If it's not in a criminal case.
Yeah, I mean these officers will probably, there's certainly departmental regulations they violated. At some level, they are going to be held responsible, but not at the level of a criminal conviction for what they were charged with. It's, as having been on the street as a police officer, I mean, my natural instinct is to give the police the benefit of the doubt, because I'm not a young black man in the city. So, of course, my perspective is influenced by who I am. I don't discount those other perspectives. It is hard to put yourself in other people's shoes. And that's why these discussions are good, because you get to see all the various sides of the issue.
All right. Well, Peter Muskos, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Peter Muskos is author of Cop in the Hood, and he's a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He joined us from his home in Queens. And Kai Wright, thanks very much to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Kai Wright is a columnist for TheRoot.com. He wrote a column about the culture of fear that police have toward black people, and he joined us from NPR, New York.